Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of hardships face working Americans at the lowest end of the income spectrum, and should the blame for their struggles rest with individuals themselves or with the society in which they are struggling to keep their heads above water? My guest today views the continued presence of widespread poverty in a country as wealthy as the United States not as a tragedy but as a scandal. And he joins us now to talk about the policies and attitudes that have helped to lock millions of Americans into financial hardships they cannot escape. Sasha Abramski is a freelance journalist and part-time lecturer in the writing program at the University of California, Davis. His new book is called The American Way of Poverty: How the Other Half Still Lives. Sasha, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris.
It's been half a century since Michael Harrington published his watershed book, The Other America. Tell us about what he described then and about what has and has not changed in the decades since.
Yeah, Harrington was an absolutely fascinating character. He was a social activist, a chronicler of poverty, a chronicler of American hardship. And he was operating in the post-war period, and it was a period of affluence. It was a period when the political classes basically crafted a narrative that said poverty is something that we used to have to deal with. It was a problem in the Great Depression. It was a problem in the years when Jacob Riis was photographing slums in New York. But it doesn't exist in the 1950s and 60s. We've gone beyond that. We've become a very wealthy, affluent society. And Harrington, who had done a lot of work with the homeless, a lot of work with the hungry, who had spent time interviewing people in SROs and so on, he didn't buy into that narrative. He said, there's something missing here. There's an awful lot of people here who are poor. Their lives are characterized by insecurity and hardship, but they've become invisible to the broader society. They've been swept under the carpet. And so he set himself a task, and his task was to make visible a group of people that he termed the other America. And he went around interviewing them. He went around describing their lives, describing their daily struggles. And he wrote this book, and it served as a moral challenge to America's leadership classes half a century ago. He basically said, look, you've crafted this affluence of narrative of affluence. It's partially true, but it's largely incomplete. Here's the more complete story. Do something about it. And he put that out there, and it was such a moral challenge that Lyndon Johnson in 1964 essentially pivots off of Harrington's work to launch the war on poverty. Now, one of the things Harrington did is he says in his book, he says, look, if we don't take this seriously, not just for a year or two, but if we don't take this seriously as an ongoing national crisis, we're going to have the same problem a half century from now, and other people are going to be chronicling similar situations. So one of the things I've done in my book is I've set myself the task of exploring the lives of many, many millions of Americans who are living the kind of economic poverty that Harrington would have understood half a century ago. And it's not 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. By the government's own estimates, 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 Americans, about 50 million people, live at or below the poverty line. It's an absolutely huge part of the American story today. And so I think what you see is you see a world of daily insecurity. You see a world of unpalatable choices. Do I pay my rent? Do I feed my children? Do I buy necessary medicines? And if I do that, which bill am I not going to be able to pay this month? You see a daily insecurity, and it's very corrosive. It's affecting more Americans each year, and it disproportionately affects people in the South, and it disproportionately affects children.
What strikes me about this book and this discussion is that it's a discussion that is not happening in the United States right now. In the last election cycle, everybody talked about the struggles of the middle class. Nobody talked about the struggles of the poor.
Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating. Right through the primary process, people really weren't talking about poverty. And this was in an election cycle where more people, more Americans were living in poverty than at any time in years. You go into the election process itself. The only real discussion of poverty was when Mitt Romney made that very, very ham-handed comment about 47% of Americans not paying taxes and therefore somehow being scroungers on the system. And that got a lot of ridicule. It got a lot of web coverage and so on. But it didn't really lead to an in-depth conversation about what poverty is, why it's caused, what can be done about it. Now, after the election, Obama has episodically talked about poverty, most noticeably recently at the Lincoln Memorial, when he was making a speech to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And he did say that poverty was an essential part of the conversation, that you couldn't discuss racial equality, you couldn't discuss social justice, and not discuss poverty. And I thought that was encouraging, but you're absolutely right that for much of the last several election cycles, this has been an absolutely invisible topic.
Sasha, can you talk a little bit about how we define poverty in this country? I know that the government has, you know, hard and fast figures, but they don't necessarily make accommodations for the cost of living in the place where you live. And they don't necessarily reflect to other Americans that the majority of poor people in this country are people living in households where someone is working full time.
That's right. And, you know, I think we sort of think that when government data is given out, that it's somehow sort of this God-given scientific equation. And so we think of the poverty line, and we assume there's this sort of easily recognizable line. If you're above it, you're not poor. If you're below it, you are poor. And that's not true. It's a construct. It's a convenient way of measuring a certain level of insecurity. It was created by a statistician called Molly Olshansky about 60 years ago. And it was based on the amount of money people had available for basic necessities like food, like housing, transport, and so on. She created this basket of goods. She made a calculation. She weighted it and came up with this number. And she said, if you're above this number, you're going to probably be okay. If you're below this number and the further below it you are, the more you're going to struggle. And if you're at half that level, you're going to be in what's called deep poverty, and you're really going to struggle on a daily basis. Now, you're absolutely right. It's impressionistic. So if you have a poverty measure that essentially doesn't distinguish between a very rural area with a low cost of living, let's say, and New York City or San Francisco with a staggeringly high cost of living, well, obviously, if you're in a city like New York, your rent or your mortgage obligations are going to be far higher than if you're, let's say, in a rural county in Alabama. So it isn't an absolutely accurate measure, but it does have some useful parts to it. What it does is it allows you to get some sense of how many million families worry about where they're going to get their next meal. As you said, it gives you some ability to measure how many of the working poor are going to work 30, 40, 50 hours a week, and at the end of the day still don't have enough money to buy medicines for their kids, or still send their kids to school hungry and hope that free breakfasts and free lunches will pick up the slack. It doesn't really explain the complexity of a woman like Mary Vasquez, a Walmart worker I met just outside Dallas. And she was 67 years old, and she had diabetes, she had heart conditions, she had had cancer, and she was still working at Walmart, and she was bringing home before taxes less than $2,000 a month. And she said to me, look, I'm diabetic, I'm supposed to eat properly, but all I can afford to eat are 88 cents TV dinners, or I go to bed hungry. Hmm. And this was somebody who'd worked her whole life. She was an elderly, very unwell lady, and this was the situation that she found herself in. And I think that increasingly that is the story of poverty in America. And it's really a story of inequality. It's a story of this tremendous thrust upwards, where if you have money, you get more money. If you have money, you get more access to the political process. And if you don't have money, increasingly, all of the risk for your retirement, for your health care, all of the risk gets thrown onto you as an individual. There's a Yale political scientist called Jacob Hacker, and he talks about this as the great risk shift, that as over the last few decades, our society has become more unequal. So it's led to this level of poverty and this level of insecurity that millions of working Americans experience. And I think in some ways, if you're looking for a common thread, something that more Americans experience and share as an experience than anything else, it's that insecurity and that hardship, because it affects nearly 50 million people. It's an extraordinary story of our moment.
So talk about that. The term income inequality gets thrown around all the time these days, not always sufficiently explained. What kinds of problems are created when the wealthiest Americans are gaining resources at an ever faster rate? And does that automatically mean that the poor and working classes have to be stagnating or slipping behind?
Well, what we've seen, I don't know if it automatically means that, but in reality it does mean that. Because what we've seen from about the Nixon period onwards, year in, year out, if you're at the bottom of the economy, in the bottom 20% of the economy, your real income has gone down. Now, what that means is that when you factor in inflation, cost of living, in real terms, somebody in the bottom of the economy today is fairly likely to be finding it harder to exist on a daily basis than their parents were and their grandparents were. Now, in terms of what it means at the top, what it means at the top is that we've got this sliver. We talk about the 1%, but actually the further up you go, the inequalities get even more profound. The 0.1%. Or the 0.01%. There's a sliver at the top control a staggering amount of resources. There are a few thousand families with hundreds of billions of dollars of assets between them, equaling, and I did the calculations in my book, the average income of 30 or 40 million Americans. Now, we haven't seen those levels of inequality for 100 years in America. There was recently released government data which said the last time we saw inequality anywhere near this profound in America was in the years leading up to the Great Depression in the late 1920s. And we know what happened then, that at a certain point, when all the wealth and all the influence and all the access to power is concentrated at the top, very bad political and economic decisions end up being made that end up hurting a tremendous number of ordinary working Americans. And I think we saw that to a degree with the collapse of 2007, 8, 9. And I think we're still seeing it today. We're seeing it in the fact that even though unemployment has gone down over the last few years, the income of 90% of American workers hasn't gone up. That all of the assets that are being generated by this increased productivity, all of the wealth being generated by the increased growth, are still flowing up to the top of the economic ladder. And I think that it's creating a tremendous stress on the democratic political processes of this country.
And there is no way that people without a spare income can hire lobbyists to represent their interests. And it sounds like that's the only way that you can actually get a lawmaker to represent your interests.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly you see this in the post-Citizens United world. This is a Congress, especially, where money talks. And when I was doing the research for the book, I looked up lobbyists in Washington to see how many I could find who were full-time representing the issues of poor Americans. I managed to find one lobby firm with two staff. Now, you think of the thousands of lobbyists out there representing pharmaceutical companies, banks, big oil, and so on. And it's no surprise that at the end of the day, increasingly we have a political process that either ignores the needs of the working poor and the poor, or oversimplifies their problems, stereotypes their problems, tries to blame the poor for being poor. You see it in this extraordinary policy debate we're having at the moment in Washington over food stamps. Now, I've interviewed dozens of people around the country who have nothing between them and hunger but a few hundred dollars in government food assistance each month. And the idea that these most vulnerable Americans are the ones whom Washington, D.C. is preparing to beat up on, that strikes me as an extraordinary shift in how our politics is functioning.
We pride ourselves in living in a country where everybody has a shot at moving up if they're willing to work hard. And yet anybody who looks at the way things are working has to recognize that there are good, honest, hardworking people who will not rise to a level that even puts them in the lower middle class. Why are we able to ignore that?
Well, I think it's because myth and reality are colliding here. Now, as you said, we've had this myth that we are the most upwardly mobile, socially dynamic country in the world. And for much of our history, that's been true. But one of the things that I did when I was writing my book, it's obviously a book of reportage. I interviewed a lot of people. But the other thing I had to do was really dig deep into the data, because you can't write a book on the complexity of American poverty without looking at numbers. And one of the things you find when you look at the mobility data is that in the last few decades, America has become far less socially mobile than almost any other wealthy first world democracy. Hmm. And what it means is, if you're born into poverty in America, despite the myth of upward mobility, you're much more likely to spend your life in poverty and to die in poverty than you would have been if you'd been born in a country like Sweden or France or Germany or Canada or even England, which is the only other country in the Western world with a sort of similar set of inequality data. It also means if you fall into poverty, if you're one of those people who lost your job in the recession or lost your house, or if you're one of these people who've gone into bankruptcy because of healthcare bills, and I've interviewed, again, many, many people whose stories are defined by these kind of crises, if you fall into that situation, you're going to find it far harder to rise back up the economic ladder again than in other countries.
Sasha Abramsky is with us. His new book is The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sasha Abramsky. He's a freelance journalist and part-time lecturer in the writing program at the University of California, Davis. His new book is called The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sasha, you write very movingly here about what you call the sheer loneliness of poverty. How does economic hardship affect people's ability to maintain social relationships?
Well, this was one of the things that surprised me most the more I got into this, into the reporting for this book, that oftentimes, in addition to the actual the hardships, the hunger, the stress of being poor and so on, one of the things that happens is psychological withdrawal. And I think it's because in America, we tend to socialize in a way that costs money. So if we want to go and visit friends, we oftentimes will just phone them up and say, hey, do you want to meet us at Starbucks? Let's grab a coffee. And for most of us, we don't think too much about it. We spend $2 or $3, we sit down, we have a nice conversation. Maybe we go have a meal with a friend or we go out to a movie. But I'd speak to people and they'd say, well, look, you know, the last time I went out to a meal with a friend was 5 years ago when I had a job. Last time I went to a movie, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And I'd say to them, well, you know, do you ever go out? Do you ever see people? And they say, no, we don't have the money. We don't have the resources. And the longer the poverty lasts, the longer they find themselves in hardship, the more they find themselves invisible. And I remember speaking to one guy. He was in his 50s. He'd had a business, actually, in Pennsylvania. And he'd had a heart attack, and his resulting medical bills, he hadn't had health insurance, and his resulting medical bills had bankrupted him. And he was now living on disability on a few hundred dollars a month. And he said to me, I feel absolutely worthless. He said, I can't afford anything. He said, if it wasn't for my children buying me things like toilet paper, I wouldn't be able to even just survive on the basics of life. I said to him, well, you know, do you ever go out and socialize? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, if you haven't got it, you can't do it, and I haven't got it. And I thought, you know, this is one of the great stories of modern-day poverty is the fact that for an increasing number of Americans, it does mean invisibility, and it does mean that sense of not being able to participate socially. I spoke to another man, a diabetic. He had been a chef. He got an infection in one of his legs and had needed an amputation. And again, he'd lost his job. He'd gone into bankruptcy again because of the medical bills. And he was divorced, and he had children who lived in a different county. And he said, look, I can't even afford the gas money. My new wife and I can't even afford the gas money to get to see my children. So he wasn't seeing his children. And I think that kind of story really speaks to just the horrible insecurity faced by people in America when they hit the economic skids. And the fact that it has been so ignored, that it's one of those stories that affects so many people, but the needs of those people are so ignored in the national political conversation. You mentioned earlier that I'd said it was a scandal, not a tragedy. That's why it seems to me a scandal. There's no reason in a country this wealthy that many people should be made to feel that invisible. And it seems to me it's a failure of our moral imagination that we've let this situation develop to the extent that it has.
It also puts an interesting spin on the outrage that people often report feeling when they discover that someone who is poor owns something like a television set. You know, there are people who are just so bothered to know that a person might have, you know, a TV in the house, but still, you know, request food aid.
No, I think that's true, that we generally think of the poor as being utterly undeserving. So if we do hear a story that somebody's getting government assistance, but they have a television or they have a cell phone or they have an internet connection, we suddenly get outraged and say, well, why do they need government assistance? But it seems to me that it's a very selective lack of empathy. Now, conservatives often talk about people who are getting government assistance who don't deserve it. But I doubt very much they're talking about middle-class homeowners who get thousands of dollars a year in income tax relief because they own a home. I doubt they're talking about elderly people who get thousands of dollars a year in Social Security payments. What they're talking about is one group of people who get government assistance, people who get things like food stamps or who are on temporary aid to needy families. But if you actually expanded the narrative, there's no way someone like Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich or Rick Perry would go after an elderly person for getting a Social Security check and also having a television. And there's certainly no way they'd go after their voting constituency, middle-class homeowners, and say, well, how outrageous that you have two televisions in your house and you're getting income tax relief for your home. So I think it's a very selective lack of empathy that's going on.
What did you learn, Sasha, about the diversity of American poverty?
Well, what I learned is that it really is as broad and as complex as is the American population itself. So I traveled to dozens of states when I was reporting this. I went to inner city Philadelphia, and I found people who had absolutely nothing. I went to colonias in the Southwest. Colonias are shanty towns lived in your home state of Texas, in California, New Mexico, and in a variety of states in the West and Southwest, oftentimes populated by undocumented migrants. And you see conditions of poverty that would remind a traveler of something in the third world. You see lack of electricity, lack of sewage, lack of running water. You see jerry-rigged houses made of metal, made of cardboard. You see a sort of improvised way of living that's totally unexpected in a country like the United States. I then also traveled to the Big Island in Hawaii. And again, on the back roads there, you see these self-constructed shacks, essentially, where people are living in just extraordinary conditions. No electricity, again, no running water. But on the other hand, you also see it in suburbia. So I did a lot of interviews in Stockton in California. It's one of the Central Valley towns just absolutely hammered by the housing collapse. And I spoke to a man called Matthew Joseph. He was a steel worker, and he'd lost his job. And he was on the verge of losing his home when I first met him. And he said, look, one of the strangest things about this recession is there was this period when I'd go out onto my suburban tracked streets, and the streets were full of people holding garage sales. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, all of my neighbors, they had these suburban homes, they looked affluent, but all of my neighbors, he said, had lost their jobs, and they were all selling off their possessions in garage sales, not to raise money for their children's sports team or whatever it might be, but to raise money to try and stay in their homes. He said, I've never seen the streets so active. And that's an extraordinary image of poverty, because you're talking about an area that on the surface looks like the American dream. You see very similar stories. I saw them in Las Vegas. I saw them in Phoenix, all over the Southwest, where the housing bubble burst with particular ferocity. You hear these narratives of people who thought they were middle class, but they ended up losing everything. And I think that, you know, that also feeds into the modern story of what American poverty looks like in the 21st century. It, as I said, just this extraordinary panoply of different stories.
Do middle-class people who find themselves sort of suddenly poor, does it leave them with a lasting sense of empathy, even if they are eventually able to pull out of that very challenging circumstance?
You know, I think that's an open question. I think for some people it did change the way that they identified, changed who they identified with, changed how they understood risk. I think for others it didn't. One of the things that we saw in this country after the Great Depression is the Great Depression itself lasted a finite number of years. But the legacy, the psychological legacy, was with that generation for the rest of their lives. And there are still elderly Americans today who psychologically, they were shaped by the Great Depression. There's this terminology, they're children of the Depression. And I think we're going to see that with the Great Recession as well, with the collapse in the housing market, with the collapse in the employment, in the labor market, that there's going to be a psychological legacy that will play out in America over the next decades. And it will change the way people think about security. It will change the way they think about jobs. It will change their relationship to community. It will change their understanding of what a safe investment is and so on. Exactly how it will play out, I think it's too early to see. I think we'll see that in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Eric on the line in Dallas. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Boy, this is a great topic. It's one that I've had a lot of passion about for the last 5 years or so. I've got two questions. Actually, I've got about 10, but I'll keep it to two. The first one is, can you speak to the state of the American, I guess, society or culture today as it pertains to how things were leading up to the French Revolution in terms of the disparity between the haves and the have-nots? And the second one's really more of a commentary. I'd like to get your feedback as well. There is a chart that I have printed out of my house. It's 24 by 36, and it's called Money, Where It's At, and What It's Used For. And it's a graphical depiction of the U.S. GDP. And it's spread across a wide range of categories, but it allows you to see how money is spent in this country. It's a geometrically two-scale accurate model, so you can see the taxation and how the money is spent. I share this with some of my somewhat wealthy Republican friends and find that they are as much uninformed about how the economy works from a political perspective as my poor friends, in the sense that they think that they don't want to pay for the poor, but I always argue that you actually are. We're just very inefficient the way we use our funds. So those are my two questions. I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
Eric, I think those are both absolutely great questions. I mean, your first question is, I think what you're asking is America in a revolutionary state in the way the French Revolution was triggered by social discontent in the end of the 18th century? I didn't find evidence of that. I did find evidence of extreme anger and frustration, but not in quite the same way. When you read the history books about what was happening in the years leading up to the French Revolution, there's this extraordinary outpouring of just absolute fury. And I don't think you're seeing that in America at this point. But I do think one of the things that's most interesting about recent polling is the amount of cynicism leveled towards our governing structures is just through the roof. Now, it might not be playing out in a revolutionary way, but there is that extreme sense that the political institutions that govern the society are broken, that they're not responding to the needs of ordinary Americans. You see that in approval ratings for Congress, which are in the 12-13% range. And I think that that speaks to the fact that a tremendous number of Americans recognize things have gone wrong, and they're looking for solutions. Now, where those solutions are going to come from, seems to me some of them will come from the grassroots. A lot of them will come from local and state initiatives. You see very creative things going on in many different communities around the country. You see it with credit unions in Boston, for example, working to try and keep distressed homes being occupied by the original homeowners. You see it in California with the minimum wage movement and this recent decision to increase the minimum wage to $10 an hour. You see it with some of the organizing efforts for janitors, for domestic workers and others. So I do think that people are looking for solutions. And that sort of segues into what you're saying about where the money is and how it's spent. Routinely, Americans overestimate how much we spend on the poor, whether it's the domestic poor or whether it's overseas aid. Routinely, in opinion polls, we think we're spending far more than we actually are. Turns out that you could actually fund a very good, very holistic, very comprehensive set of initiatives designed to tackle inequality, designed to tackle a lot of the causes of poverty. You could fund it with a few hundred billion dollars. And it sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But we're a $17 trillion a year economy, by far the largest economy in the world. We have the resources for anti-poverty initiatives. We have the resources to properly fund our schools. We certainly have the resources to get health care to people who need health care. We certainly have the resources to get nutritional assistance to people who need it. We have the resources to create minimum wage structures that mean that if you are working, you actually have a modicum of security and dignity in your life. We're not lacking the resources. What we're lacking is the political will. Now, it seems to me there's an analogy here. A lot of conservatives in recent years have said, well, we're essentially bankrupt. We're like Greece. That's the mantra. We've become like Greece. And everyone knows Greece is on the road to ruin. So the idea that America is becoming like Greece is designed to instill fear. Well, there's a huge difference. Greece literally is bankrupt. It has no money. It's reliant on funds from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. Every bill it pays is essentially a bill paid with borrowed money at this point. If you want the medical analogy, it's like a body suffering from cancer, being corroded by a particularly nasty disease. Well, America doesn't have cancer. America has anorexia. We're choosing to self-starve our system. We're choosing to undertax certain groups. We're choosing to throw resources towards those who already have resources and to take resources away from those who don't have resources. That's a political decision. And it seems to me that, you know, at least in part, when you're asking where the money's at, it's a conversation not about the economy. It's a conversation about the polity, the body politic.
Well, let's talk about those undertaxed groups, as you call them. When you talk about creating a poverty mitigation fund that would be paid for by, say, taxing financial transactions like stock trades and putting a greater tax on energy profits, what do you say to people who argue, listen, I have not taken these resources, I don't need them, and I'm in a position, as we hear very often, to create jobs, and therefore taking away money from my pocket to put it back into the government's pocket is just a roundabout way of creating the same jobs that I'm already giving to lower-income Americans?
I think we have a very strange and very truncated conversation at the moment in this country about who uses resources. because it seems to me that we all use resources. When I get up in the morning and I get in my car and I drive somewhere, I'm using roads that are funded by public infrastructure. When I take my kids to school, they're in a public school. And for those schools to function properly, there has to be money going into the system. When I call the police if there's an emergency, or I call the fire department, I'm relying on public infrastructure. And it seems to me that no matter how affluent one is, no matter how much one tries to divorce oneself from the broader society, at the end of the day, those public resources are important. And the idea that it's healthy societally for millions of people, let's say, to go without health care, or the idea that it's healthy societally for millions of kids to go to bed hungry at night, I don't understand that. It seems to me, A, it's a failure of the moral imagination, but as significantly, it's incredibly counterproductive. I spoke to a Harvard Kennedy School of Government lecturer called Marshall Gantz, and he said, look, you can't understand poverty as being the primary cause of other problems. Poverty itself has been caused by something. It's been caused by inequality. He said, look, no society on earth preserves its democratic structures over the centuries with the level of inequality that America is now tolerating. He said it's a form of collective self-suicide, that at a certain point, when you end up in a situation where millions and millions and then tens of millions of Americans are left out of the political process and left out of the economic conversation, at that point, it becomes increasingly difficult to keep society cohesive. And I think that's the risk, that we're now at a tipping point where the kind of society we are is shifting into something different, is shifting into something unrecognizable for a democracy. And that's dangerous. And I profoundly hope that we can have an intelligent conversation about how to alleviate poverty in this country without it being reduced to the sorts of stereotypes and name-calling that seem to be occurring in Washington at the moment.
My guest is Sasha Abramski. He's a freelance journalist and part-time lecturer in the writing program at UC Davis. His new book is called The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sasha Abramski about his new book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find David on the line in McKinney. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I was just calling, and I appreciate some of the things they say. You know, there is a place for government with helping people that really need help. By no means am I rich. I work three jobs and try to start my own little business. My wife works. And together we only make $50,000 a year. But there's a place for personal responsibility also. I think too much of the conversation is on what the government should do for people. People need to get up and do for themselves.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think, Sasha?
No, I don't disagree with that. I think, of course, there's an important place for personal responsibility in any conversation. But I also think that there are structural changes that have occurred in the economy in the last few years that have acted like a tsunami and have swept the livelihoods and the prospects of millions of families away. So with the housing collapse, for example, millions of people lost their homes, and with it, they lost their life savings. And to say that all of the response to that is about promoting personal responsibility, I'm not sure how those families are supposed to get back on their feet when oftentimes the jobs aren't there. Oftentimes if the jobs are there, they're far away and they can't afford to move because they're stuck in underwater homes. It seems to me that things have changed at a level that affects society, not just individuals. So case in point being that even though unemployment for the last 3 years has gone down, we still have over 7% of the workforce unemployed. We still have millions of people who are so discouraged from the labor market, they've just withdrawn. They're called jobless. They're not counted in unemployment data, but they do not have work. And then we have millions more people who do have work, and sometimes they have more than one job, but they still can't pay their bills. And I spoke to someone in Northern California, an old man who'd run a food kitchen, a food pantry for decades. And he said, look, oftentimes my neighbors say to me, the month is longer than the paycheck. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I've got friends and neighbors, and they work full time, and come week three in the month, they've run out of money, and they're not going to get a paycheck for another week. And those guys need a bridging mechanism. They need help. They need food assistance. They need medical assistance sometimes because they cannot make all of their bills. They cannot pay all of their bills. And I think that when the caller talks about the need for personal responsibility, it's a starting point, but it's not a sufficient conversation. There has to be a broader conversation, A, about why so many people are falling into economic insecurity, and B, about structural changes, because any society is essentially a compilation of choices. If we choose to undertax wealthy people, well, almost definitionally, we're going to have to starve our public infrastructure. If other countries choose different tax rates, well, they're going to have more money available for public infrastructure. It's a series of choices, and it's those choices that I'm hoping that we can have a smarter, longer conversation about in the coming months.
What kind of inoculation does a college degree provide against poverty, and what would it take to provide an affordable education for people who come from families that do not have the resources to pay that tuition?
No, that's a great question, because the narrative in this country about education is always that if you get educated, it's your ticket out of poverty. And it's true to a point. There's no doubt about it that if you get a college degree, on average, you're going to earn more money than if you just have a high school degree. And if you have a high school diploma, you're going to, on average, earn more money than a high school dropout. So the higher up the education ladder you do go, there's a greater likelihood you're going to earn more over a lifetime. You're also, to a degree, insulated from the job market collapse. And there certainly were large numbers of college-educated people in America in 08, 09, and 2010 who did lose their jobs. But fewer, a lower percentage of college-educated Americans ended up unemployed than was the case for people without a college degree. But the other part of the story is debt. And in the last few years, this has become one of the huge contributors to insecurity, is that as public infrastructure has rolled back, I'm in California, for example, the amount of money the state is putting into the universities plummeted in the wake of 2008. Now, those universities had to find some way to make up the difference. And the way they made up the difference was massive increases in tuition. And the way that my students and many students around the state paid for that increase in tuition, if they could get jobs, they did. Many of them couldn't, and they ended up in debt. And they ended up borrowing tens of thousands of dollars. And that's a debt that's going to have a huge impact on them for the rest of their working lives. Now, one of the things in my book, I talk a lot about solutions, because it seems to me you can talk about poverty until you're blue in the face. But one of the important things about talking about poverty is talking about ways to alleviate poverty. And so I put out there a series of important policy changes that I think would have an impact on poverty. And when it comes to education, I argue for something called an educational opportunity fund. And it would be a sort of front-ended social insurance system in the same way as we have Social Security. We all pay into it. We pay into it through taxes. Our employers pay into it through taxes. And at the end of the day, it allows for people to retire with a modicum of security. Well, you could do the same thing and you could front-end it. You could basically have a line, a small income tax, 0.25% to start with is what I advocate in the book. And it would basically seed a higher education fund. So every child born in America would have a few thousand dollars put aside for them at birth that would be invested and over the next 18 years would grow into a sizable pool of money to make higher education affordable. Now, people might say, well, you know, what if I don't go to college? How's that fair? So what I argue in my book is if you don't go to college, that money will stay in your Social Security account. That money, you'll get it at birth, and instead of it being used at college, it will stay in your Social Security account, and over six, 7 decades will grow into a considerable pool of money and will add to your security as a senior citizen. Now, it seems to me that there are creative solutions. That's just one solution. But there are ways of making higher education more affordable. There are ways of pooling the risk around higher education. So we regard it as a social asset, a social good. And we find ways of funding it that don't lead young students to being chronically in debt for the first 10 or 20 years of their careers. And it seems to me that we should have those conversations because we're too big a country to let these problems swamp us. And at the moment, they are swamping us because through political paralysis, we're absolutely failing to find ways to address these crises.
Talk about your idea to create a public works fund to sort of protect against massive unemployment in times of economic upheaval.
Yeah, it borrows some of the ideas from the New Deal period. Mm-hmm. One of the things that was most devastating to people in the wake of the 2008 financial collapse was the rapidity of the unemployment crisis, the fact that in a relatively short period of time, a matter of months, well over 10 million jobs just vanished. They were gone, and the livelihoods associated with those jobs were gone. And people who had thought they were absolutely immune from being laid off or being fired suddenly found themselves claiming unemployment benefits, suddenly found themselves claiming food stamps, massively had to recalibrate their economic expectations. So one of the things I say in the book is, look, again, let's use social insurance in a smart way. We do it to a degree with unemployment insurance. But why not have another very small, very manageable tax? And again, you can't do any of these without being willing to raise a little bit of money through taxation. But why not have a small tax that would allow for the creation of a pool of money that the federal government manages that would never be used except in unemployment emergencies? But if there was a crisis such as the one in 2008 where millions of jobs are disappearing overnight, the money is there and it can be released quickly and it can be put into public works programs or it can be put into subsidizing wages during periods when large companies are having crises. There's no reason it couldn't be done. Other countries have worked to do similar things. Other countries have worked to create models that smooth out these crises so that when there is an economic crisis, the resources are there to stopgap. The resources are there to make sure that millions of families don't suddenly end up destitute. And I think that those kind of funds are important for two reasons. One, just in and of themselves, they're a social good. The second thing is that for decades, part of the conservative project has been to convince America that the government can only sell lemons, that it can only sell second and third rate product. Now, if you convince enough Americans that government's incapable of delivering anything effectively, well, of course people are going to be opposed to paying taxes. And of course they're going to view anything public as inherently bad. But that didn't used to be the case. It wasn't the case when Social Security was created. It wasn't the case when Medicare was created. And it seems to me if you can create a couple linchpin programs like that, a couple signature programs that would do for the 21st century what Social Security did for the 20th, that's when you can have a much broader conversation about social equality and about social insurance and about what kind of obligations community entails.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Juan on the line in Dallas. Hello, Juan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My call. Long time no talk to you, but the gentleman you have on the program, he seems to have the whole picture on his head. And I wonder whether if people in the country are a little bit hypnotized or they don't live on reality. And I was wondering about the point that he brought up about France or Napoleon during the revolution, whether it will happen here anytime. And I think that the reason that it has not happened is that people that are frustrated and passed through the hardship on their lives that could bring to that point, that situation, they might be in jail.
What do you think about that, Sasha?
Well, first of all, it's a very generous comment of yours. I'm not sure I do have all the answers in my head. But I do think that, you know, again, that you're now the second caller to talk about the French Revolution. I do think there are differences because the mechanisms for change actually already exist in America. We have a democratic political system. We have a franchise. We have things that the population in France could never have dreamt of 220, 230 years ago. So I do think the situation is different. But I think the caller just talked about something very interesting, which is the in a sense, passivity of a lot of people in the face of what's going on in America at the moment. There's movements in Europe which seem to me quite creative on this. There's the indignance movement in Spain, for example. Spain's a country with massive unemployment and a massive poverty epidemic. And there's been some rather creative thinking around political responses to poverty. Now, it seems in America, there are people very active. I spoke to a lot of people who are finding their own niche. They're finding their own ways of getting involved, their own ways of protesting, their own ways of developing solutions. But so far, we haven't seen a collective movement for change. Now, I don't think that that's an inevitability. It seems to me these things can percolate below the surface and then very, very quickly bubble up to the surface. And you saw that in the 1960s. And again, sort of cycling back to what we talked about nearly an hour ago, when Michael Harrington was writing about poverty in America, at the time, almost nobody was talking about it. Congressmen weren't talking about it. Presidency wasn't putting much attention behind it. The media wasn't paying much attention, and academics weren't paying much attention. This was in the late 50s, early 60s. And Harrington becomes a part of a national conversation. And within a few years, everybody's talking about it. We have a war on poverty. We have think tanks devoted to alleviating poverty. We have pilot programs going on at a local level. And the debate and the discourse around poverty and around inequality and around responses to it shifted very quickly. So it seems to me that we might be seeing the same thing today, that there are an awful lot of organizations out there doing very, very creative work. Now, whether or not that's going to percolate into the national political conversation, which is where it needs to be, that's an open question. But I do think there's at least a chance that we're going to change here, that there is room for change at the moment.
We just have about a minute left, but I don't want to close the hour without talking about this, because you clearly empathize with the hardships faced by Americans in poverty. But rather than simply pitying them, you also came away quite impressed by their resilience. Will you talk about the source of that resilience?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's actually a very similar story to the one that Catherine Boo writes about in her book on India called Behind the Beautiful Forever, mm-hmm. that if you just talk about poor people as passive, as people who are having bad things done to them, you miss the complexity of their story. Because despite the stereotypes, most poor people are anything but passive. They do everything they can to improve their lot. They go to universities if they can afford it. They go into job training programs. They work two or three jobs to feed their kids. They're incredibly creative and dynamic in their responses to their situation. So nothing in my book is intended to indicate that only the government can solve their problems. But I do think it's important to say that the government is the only institution big enough to tie all of these strands together, and that you can have people with the most creative, optimistic outlook on life, but at a certain point, if they are that economically destitute, they will need a step up. They will need some kind of assistance, whether it's from the federal government or the state. And it's the complexity, it's that interplay between private dynamism and public that I think is one of the fascinating stories here.
The new book by Sasha Abramski is called The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Sasha, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, I've much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast at kera.org/think and send comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.